welcoming the delegation of Registrar, CEO, and board members of Council for Medical Skills. I need to prepare you that you are going to really say quite a lot this afternoon, what you prepared and what you probably didn't prepare, because some of the things that came from the marketing, health market inquiry, are touching your governance. You can't be silent on that. But thank you very much for responding to some of our questions. I don't know how you plan to make a presentation to us, or you want to take these questions as read. The members will guide me. There's a very interesting response that is coming from Council of Medical Students. I read it and I finished it and I said it again. It's very interesting. Absolute powerful information. But I don't think our members will. I'll take it as read, but I would want you to probably engage with this also. These are good responses, they're helpful. But let me then give you the way you would want to present to us. We have agreed that it's not more than a month since we met, and therefore we will skip the item of introductions. Safe to say, when your members are responding to issues, then they must just remind us again who they are as they respond. But we have had some apologies of some of our members because of certain family challenges that they are gone, but we still are. Nine of us are here, nine members are still here, so we are really still a big team. We'll give you to you, Registrar, to take us through the presentation, which I saw in the big, is this big document? And he's hoping to do all 195 slides. I'm just, as I have said in my preamble, we have been with you a month ago. You note some of the slides that you told us about in less than a month ago. And you take that those slides we are familiar with and go to us on the key issues and touch on the issues on the financials we need to. Auditor General is still here, and they spoke good things about you yesterday. Continue doing those good things, because whatever you do good things, Auditor General observes you. When you start doing bad things, they will still observe you. So it's a very funny group of people. They observe the good and the bad, and they report your bad and the good. So far, they told us of your good story, and we congratulate you on that good story that they told us. But I'm also informed also of the other challenges that the Auditor General may not be able to stay right through the presentation, but they are here to support us and you on the things. But yesterday they did speak well about you. And then I give you now the opportunity to take us through your... Members are interested to really discuss reports with you. So don't hide your time by taking us through all the different... One of the things that you did well was to send us a report the day before. So members are not going to be saying read word for word. Some of the slides, you can look at it and we take that simple slide, easy to understand, so that you give them space and time to interact with the report. Thank you very much. Go ahead now.
My name is Clarence Mini. I'm the chairperson of Council for Medical Scheme. Just to say indeed, good afternoon to you and to the committee members. And we are quite aware of the fact that we were here quite recently, and we don't intend going through the same report with our team. But there are issues that we've worked on, including the Health Marketing Inquiry report, and we know, as everyone does, that report has just been handed over to the Minister of Health, who is the executive authority for us will be taking the report through the various stages and will be working with him in that. And our understanding is that the journey that the report is going to take is going to end up in cabinet, and at the end is coming here too. So we, at this point, we've noted all the recommendations and we're discussing them with the minister. And of course, you know the Section 59 investigation that we have, and the registrar is going to touch on that to put you up to date about how far the process is going. And the involvement of the SIU through the proclamation that was signed by Minister Mtsoaledi and the President. So all those processes are ongoing. And as you directed, all the colleagues, when they present their part, they are going to introduce themselves and say what they are doing in the various sections. I'll hand over to the registrar to start. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson of Council, and Honorable Members. There's five of us, so we've broken down the presentation into five parts. I'll start with the first one, and then my colleagues will talk to the finances and other key aspects of the report. But, Chairperson, there will be slides where, you know, in order to save time, where we can move faster. And that's where we are talking about the programmatic performance, you know, against set targets. I think there we can save some time. But thank you for the opportunity. The key areas of the report basically includes the annual performance information for 2018-2019, the annual financial statements, as well as the industry report. So I'm going to deal largely with the annual performance information for 2018-19. That's just our macro organizational structure. I think we presented that last time. And we also covered, you know, the goals that we're operating under in the year in question. So I will also not touch on these yet. So going straight into the aggregated performance on set objectives for the CMS for 2018-19 year. Our overall performance sits at 80%, and this score excludes the 18% of partial achievement, and basically it's within the benchmark set by the Auditor General. There are just two areas where there was a negative performance, and that is in sub-program 1.4, which is the HR sub-program, and program 2 of the strategies office. And then the rest, it's program 6 and 9, which is compliance and investigation, and the complaints adjudication, which demonstrate and account for this 18%. There was also an indicator which accounts for 2%, which through discussions with Auditor General, these were labeled as not applicable. Now, the presentation that I'm going to be making is covered in the hard copy of the main annual report between pages 25 and 54. So this slide just demonstrates the areas of achievement. That we achieved 80%, partial achievement of 18%, and 2% of this was non-applicable. Our overall audit outcome was an unqualified audit in terms of the performance information as well as the financials. Yes, there were four material findings that were raised, as well as nine material misstatements that we had to correct here through the audit process. Just a brief slide that talks about the highlights is that an unqualified report by the Auditor General. We also maintained a good record of maintaining our ICT systems uptime at over 99%. We increased our research output to address industry challenges and contribute to policy development. We also increased our stakeholder reach and interaction, training and empowering of key stakeholders. The appeals process was also strengthened and streamlined. There was also improvement in the reduction of complaints.
But honorable members, we also just wanted to highlight that we did host a successful industry fraud, waste and abuse conference between February and March this year, where we brought all the industry players to set down the rules of the game. Just a brief touch on the areas where there was underperformance and what strategies we've put in place. The first program that I want to talk to is the HR program. We had 16 vacancies during this period, and 12 were filled within the 120-day turnaround time. But we had, you know, challenges with filling of other posts, hence this partial achievement. And basically, we've corrected this through, you know, resolving the disputes around appointments of individuals and also ensuring that we fast-track the appointments. The strategist's office also had a problem of a backlog of clinical opinions, but this was corrected through the appointment of clinical analysts that were able to deal with the backlogging. And then in terms of the areas of partial achievement, this basically involved the compliance and investigations unit, and it's more a technical issue here, where in the setting of targets, you know, we didn't account for those cases that came at the tail end of the financial year and had to be dealt with outside the reporting period, but we're correcting that formula. And then there was also the complaints and adjudication section. This is the one area, honorable members, where CMS is struggling a bit. And it's due to high staff turnover, and we also have capacity issues, but we also think we need to improve our processes and the ICT systems that we're using to address this, because we've accumulated quite a bit of a backlog here, and this has led to us failing to meet our targets. The detailed performance by program here. Chairperson, I'll just touch this in detail on a programmatic basis, but I think the detailed, you know, presentation can actually be seen in the presentation itself and in the report here. But if you look at the first sub-program 1.2, which is the CFO's office, we had set ourselves three targets based on the indicators and objectives, and all of three of these were achieved. In terms of program, sub-program 1.3, which is our ICT and knowledge management, we had set ourselves four targets, and all four were achieved. Sub-program 1.4, which is HR, I've already indicated that out of the five targets that were set, three were achieved, and two were partially achieved. The sub-program 1.5 is legal, and the two targets indicators that were set were achieved. And then the strategist program, number two, it has had seven indicators, or rather targets based on the indicators. Five of these were achieved, two were partially achieved. And then program number three, which is accreditation, yes, all three were achieved. And then in program four, R&M, two were set and they were all achieved. Program five, the same. Program six, we had two targets. One was achieved, one was partially achieved. And then in program seven, benefits management, we had two targets. These were achieved. Program eight, five targets, three achieved, one partially achieved. And then one was declared as not applicable. And then in complaints, we had one target indicator, and this was partially achieved. Chairperson, the next part of the presentation, in other words, from slide 12 to slide number 28, this is a repetition of what I've just said, but it's talking to the specific, you know, indicator and objective. And I think, you know, given the fact that we shared the presentation with honorable members, perhaps this is where we can save time. These are also reports that are covered in the main annual report here, between pages 29 and pages 54. So I think, Chairperson, if you agree, then we can skip that part and basically take the next part of the presentation, which would be the annual financial statements.
Good afternoon, Dr. Tlomo and honorable members of Parliament. It is an honor for me to present the annual financial statements for the financial year 1 April 2018 to 31st March 2019. My name is Cindy Grieflink and I'm in the finance unit of the Council for Medical Schemes. My purpose today is mainly to demonstrate to the committee the accountability of the CMS for the resources entrusted to us as a regulatory authority responsible for the medical schemes industry. But before I dive into the financial statements as outlined on the screen, I would like to go through the Auditor General's report as our independent auditors. CMS received an unqualified audit opinion of the financial statements, meaning that the financial statements present fairly in all material respects the financial position, financial performance and cash flow for the year ending 31st March. Without modifying the audit opinion, an emphasis of matter paragraph was included in the Auditor General's report, highlighting the restatement of corresponding figures as disclosed in Note 25 and Note 28. Of the financial statements. As already discussed by the Registrar, Dr. Kabane, the usefulness and reliability of the performance information of 5 out of 9 programs within CMS were evaluated by the Auditor General, and no material findings on the usefulness and reliability of these programs were reported as management corrected all the misstatements noted. With regards to compliance with legislation, the Auditor General reported non-compliance with Section 551A and 551B of the Public Finance Management Act, as well as non-compliance with Treasury Regulation 166A1. Section 551A and B of the PFMA requires the accounting authority for a public entity to keep full and proper records of the financial affairs of the public entity and prepare financial statements for each financial year in accordance with the generally accepted accounting practices. As the Auditor General identified material misstatements in expenditure in the submitted financial statements that were subsequently corrected by management and disclosed in Note 25 and 28, the Auditor General raised the non-compliance with this two sections. On the Treasury Regulation 16A61, it requires for goods and services to be within the threshold of values as determined by National Treasury. The AG noted that some of the procurement transactions below the value of 500,000 were procured without obtaining the required price quotation. These non-compliance with key legislation is also then reported by the Auditor General due to internal deficiencies within the organization being the root cause. In the last paragraph of the AG's report, the AG highlighted note 26 of the financial statements dealing with an investigation currently in progress on possible cover quoting, and we are busy with the investigation of that issue. Right, now we can dive into the financial statements. A brief overview of the financial position of the CMS at the end of 31st March 2019 indicates the reduction of total assets, total liabilities, and accumulated surplus funds. The total assets reduced by 14.5 million from 61 million to 46.5 million. Total liabilities reduced by 3.7 million and then accumulated funds reduced by 10.8 million from 19.2 million to 8.4 million. A closer look at the CMS assets shows that although total assets reduced by 31% from the previous financial year to the current financial year, the liquidity of CMS is still healthy, as cash and cash equivalents contribute 57% of total assets. Payables from exchange transactions makes up 63% of our total liabilities, and the building that we occupy and operate from is leased, and this operating lease makes up 25% of our total liabilities. Our conditional grant received from the our executive authority, NDOH, not yet spent at year end, makes up 7% of total liabilities, and provisions 5%. CMS incurred a deficit of 10.8 million at the end of 31st March 2019, and the main reason for this deficit is due to the implementation of National Treasury's Instruction Note 6 of 2017-2018. In terms of this instruction note, public entities listed in Schedule 3A and 3C of the PFMA may not accumulate surpluses that were realized in the previous financial year without obtaining prior written approval from the National Treasury. Total revenue of 168 million was received by the CMS in the 2018-2019 financial year. CMS is substantially funded, 86% of the total revenue, through levies imposed on principal members of medical schemes in terms of the Council of Medical Schemes Levies Act No. 58 of 2000. Accreditation fees, registration fees, appeal fees, and regulation fees received from entities that CMS regulates amounts to 7% of total revenue. Government transfer, mainly from our executive authority, National Department of Health, constitute only 4% of our revenue. Total expenditure of 178 million was incurred in the current financial year. 63% of the total expenditure is for the compensation of employees. 20% of total expenditure accounts for operating expenditure, and 13% of total expenditure accounts for the administrative expenditure. Operating expenditure contributes 20% of total expenditure of the organization. In this category of expenditure, the main cost categories are inspection fees at 20%, legal fees at 17%, consultation fees at 15%, and travel and subsistence at 11%. The main administrative expenditure of the organization is towards the building that we occupy. Rent and building expenses makes up 66% of our administrative expenditure. 98% of our total budget was utilized in the financial year. Irregular expenditure increased by 16.1 million during the current financial year, from 28.2 million in the prior year to 44.4 million in the current financial year. Irregular expenditure of 14.9 million, 93% recovered under the 2018-2019 financial year, was expenditure from previous financial years, which relates to the panel of inspectors and legal advisors not established according to the prescribed processes. Both these panels are now in place following the prescribed processes. Irregular expenditure is defined as spending incurred in contravention of key legislation, where goods and services have been delivered but prescribed processes were not followed. During the 2018-19 financial year, three transactions amounting to 1.1 was reported as being irregular expenditure. At the end of the financial year, two transactions were still under investigation to determine whether it constitutes irregular expenditure as defined. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure is expenditure incurred in vain, which should have been avoided to the, if reasonable care has been taken, amounts to 31,000 rand in 2018-2019 financial year. And this relates to a venue which was paid but not utilized and the overpayment of leave gratuity to the amount of 27,000 and 4,000 respectively. To conclude, 98% of our resources entrusted to the CMS as the regulatory authority of medical schemes were utilized in the 2018-2019 financial year. 10.8 million deficit incurred by the CMS is due to the utilization of accumulated surplus funds, and the liquidity of the CMS is still healthy at the end of the 2018-2019 financial year. I'm going to hand over to Michael.
Thank you, Cindy. To the Honorable Chair of the Portfolio Committee, the committee members, thank you for the opportunity to also come and present the findings of the, or the final output of the annual report. My name is Michael Willie. I'm in the Research and Monitoring Division at the Council for Medical Schemes. The main purpose of the presentation is just to touch on the membership of medical schemes and then also some of the utilization trends that we've seen in the past over the period and also do a comparison between 2017 and 2018. So in the main, what we're seeing in the sector is that we're seeing that now we're having fewer medical schemes compared to previous years. But that consolidation has not been pronounced if you look at 2017 and 2018. At some point we used to have about 140 medical schemes, but now that figure has reduced to around 279 medical schemes as at December 2018. But if we were to compare that figure to 2017, for instance, we had 80 medical schemes. So that says that between the period 2017 and 2018, we lost only one medical scheme. So as of December 2018, we had 79 medical schemes in total. In the main, we're observing that previously we just used to see smaller medical schemes being absorbed by big schemes. But that is sort of like stabilized if you were to compare 2014 to 2018, whereby we had in the region of about 80 medical schemes. But we do expect the consolidation trend to continue over the next coming years. And then also, if you were to look at the number of benefit options that we see in the medical schemes, remember in the sector we've got two types of medical schemes. We've got the open schemes as well as the restricted, sometimes called the employer-based types of medical schemes. So in the main, on average, your open schemes, they offer about six benefit options, but your employer-based types of medical schemes, they offer about three main benefit options. So your open schemes, you've got basically three times more types of benefit options than you'll find in your employer-based type of medical schemes. But obviously, this is just an average. But if you were to look at the range is between anything between two to about 23 benefit options, but obviously one has to break that down in terms of your networks and efficiency discount types of benefit options.
Sorry, Mr. Michael, assume that we know this type of jargon. Let us not lose you because you are developing a new terminology that we don't know yet.
Okay.
Open schemes, restricted schemes, define and then tell us those options so that we can go back on the basics of it.
All right, thank you, Chair. So basically your open schemes, they basically admit everyone, right? As long as you're able to afford the premium and you're able to join the medical scheme, they need to basically enroll you. But your employer-based types of schemes, for instance, will be like your medical schemes, like your BMW. If you work for BMW, then you are more inclined to join that medical scheme. But if you work for a typical example of like if you work for government, you are more inclined to join GEMS as a medical aid. And if you work for parliament, then you are more likely to join the parliament. So that's just a distinction between the two. So it's more employer-based, your restricted scheme or your your employer-based types of schemes linked to the type of employment or sector that one basically operates in. And then while the open schemes, basically, they admit irrespective, as long as they're able to afford the premium, then they may admit you. So if we were to look at the trend over time, like I indicated, in 2018, we had 9.92 million lives compared to 8.87 in 2017. But what we have seen in the industry is that the medical scheme sector hasn't grown significantly over time. What you see, almost like on a year, if you look at your year-to-year growth, it's, a lot of the time it's less than 1%. The only period where you saw a significant growth in the sector was when in the introduction of GEMS, whereby if you were to compare the period 2005 and 2011, the growth was significant, was more than 80% in the restricted scheme sector and close to 40% in the open scheme sector. So in such a general, you don't really see a significant growth share. It's, a lot of the time, it's less than 1%. Now, if we were to split the beneficiaries in terms of geographical location, what we see is that you see quite a lot of beneficiaries, they reside basically in Gauteng, and then 40% of them are basically, of that 8.92 are basically based in Gauteng, and then about 14% is based in KZN, and then about 15% of the beneficiaries are based in Western Cape. So those three provinces combined, they account for more than 50% of what is covered by medical schemes. Then you do find other provinces like Northwest, for instance, they've got small ratios compared to others. So this is based on the December 2018. But if you were to look at the growth at province level, comparing 2017 and 2018, a lot of growth is basically seen in the northwest area, Limpopo, Northern Cape. Your Gauteng province, for instance, experienced a growth of less than 1%, and Mpumalanga a growth of basically a decline of 0.8%. But I must put a disclaimer here to say that a lot of the times this data is computed through the pay point of a beneficiary. Sometimes it may not necessarily be a true reflection. You might find that there are beneficiaries that actually work in the Platinum Section Northwest Province, for instance, that the pay point is at a particular location. But it does give insights in terms of where most of the beneficiaries are. A greater percentage of them will reflect a true representation by geographical area. And then the other thing that we saw in the industry, we're seeing a growth in terms of the, or basically aging of medical scheme members, where the average age, weighted average age of medical scheme members in 2017 was 32.6. This grew by 0.2. This is now, in terms of magnitude, to 32.8 in 2018. But the interesting thing that we note is that you do see that there's quite a lot of growth in your sort of like elderly type of population, in the age band above 30 to 39, where there is significantly quite a number of people joining those age bands. But we do see a decline in your, what you call your young and healthy, which you really need in the medical scheme sector to be able to employ the principle of cross-subsidization, mainly in the age band of 15 to 19, as well as 25 to 29. That is mainly where you lose a lot of the times your dependents, because if they're just in age, then you lose them off the medical aid. But what we see, it is a slow uptake of those members when they almost get to the age of 20 to 29. And you really, those are the kind of beneficiaries that you need in the sector to be able to realize basically the principle of cross-subsidization, because in the sector basically need both the young and healthy so that the young can cross-subsidize the older ones. Now, if you look at the health and the benefits paid for provisions of healthcare services, what we saw was a growth of 8%, whereby basically medical schemes spent 173 billion in 2018. Sorry, Chair, I think the battery is about to die here. I don't know if there's a chance. So medical schemes, they spent 173 billion in 2018 compared to 160.5 in 2017. So this is a growth of about 8%. But if you were to compare this to your CPI, for instance, CPI increase is significantly high. So it's about 3% higher, almost 4% higher than your CPI. I mean the average CPI in 2018. So it means therefore that health care over the same period has become more expensive for ordinary or for beneficiaries. But if you were to look at an individual person, for instance, you look at the average spend per person by medical schemes, that has increased by 6.63, which is still higher than the inflationary increase, whereby on average in 2017, medical schemes spent about 18,000 per person, and that increased to almost 20,000 in 2018. And in the sector you find that you've got your pool of funds, which is like the total benefits paid, but then that is split into two. That is, now you've got your risk benefit as well as your savings benefit. Your risk benefit is mainly that pays for your relevant health care expenses. When you really get sick, then the medical schemes then can pull out funds from that can basically pay funds from that pool, which accounts for 90% of the healthcare spend. Similarly, here we saw a growth of 8.1% between 2017 and 2018, and then again, if you were to relate that to pay beneficiary per month from the risk pool now, which accounts for 90% of benefits paid, that increased by 6.73. Mirrors what you see at global level for total benefits paid, but both these figures are slightly higher than your basically the CPI. And then again, the benefits paid from the savings account increased by 6.81. So what it does depict a picture that really your health care is becoming more and more expensive if you're to compare to your ordinary, and which really impacts significantly on the affordability by members of schemes. And then again, in the medical scheme sector, you do find there's a set of benefits that your medical aid has to pay in full, and then these are called prescribed minimum benefits. These types of benefits in 2018, they accounted for more than half of what was paid by medical scheme, which was about 87.8 billion, and this account for 50.7% of your 173 billion that was paid in 2018. So here I'm depicting the benefits paid per discipline. So the slide is very important because what it does, if I was to explain it in simple terms, it would be, if you pay 100 rand contribution to a medical aid, where does most of the money go? So in the main, 37 rands of 100 rand that you pay to medical aid goes to private hospitals, and then 15 rands goes to medicines. And then the other element or the other portions of that is your specialist costs, which account for about 25 rands. So those three components in the main, they account for more than 80% of what you pay for your medical aid in 2018. And then we basically call these the sort of like the cost drivers, but they're really main contributors to the increasing healthcare spend in the medical scheme sector. And then there's also another element of copay. Here, the concerning issue that we pick up with regards to this slide is that it looks like there is an increasing trend of the out-of-pocket payment. This is basically what you necessarily, ordinarily, you claim from your service provider, and then the medical aid will pay, but there is a portion of copayment that has to come from the member. And this can be in two forms. It can be direct payment by the member and also a payment through the medical, the MSA bill. Ordinarily, we would not lump these into one, but this is just for illustration purposes to say that of what comes out of your pocket, or basically your savings as a member, how much has been spent over the period. So, but what we see, the concerning issue here is that the out-of-pocket payment, if we were to compare 2014 to 2018, has increased by almost 40%, 37%. So similarly, of what the members pay from their own pocket has become even more and more expensive in the healthcare sector. So it really basically depicts a picture of challenges that are faced by medical scheme aid members. So here, basically, we are trying to depict the benefits paid per visit. So the interesting thing about this slide is to basically show you in terms of the benefit design, because when the medical aid pays, there's basically two types of benefits that they pay. They'll normally pay for in-hospital and out-of-hospital benefits. So your in-hospital type of benefit, for instance, is like when you are being hospitalized, you're in a hospital setting, then those are the funds that will go towards that. Sometimes you do find that there might be a general practitioner who sits in a hospital setting, or sometimes you find that a general practitioner who sits in his own independent practice in a specific area outside the hospital setting. But because of the benefit design, what you pick up here is that your GP course, for instance, is more expensive if you go to somebody who sits in a, who is sort of like located in a hospital setting. It's almost three times more than when you go to an ordinary GP that sits on outside hospital setting. But obviously, what we haven't taken into account here is the various factors. One of the factors, for instance, is that the average time that a particular individual in hospital setting takes while consulting a doctor compared to the someone who's sitting, who's seeing a doctor on an outside hospital setting. Obviously, there are a lot of processes that happen if somebody sits in hospital setting. But the long and short of it is that healthcare is more expensive if you treat someone in hospital setting than when you treat them on an out-of-hospital setting. But what it does here, it basically shows you how the benefit design by medical scheme sort of like set up. It has become more hospice-centric. So there's a lot of expenditure in an in-hospital setting than, for instance, your primary health care, you know, whereby you pay a lot of money for, basically you pay a minimum amount of money for your primary health care benefit so that you avoid your downstream cost of somebody being hospitalized, which would be slightly less cheaper than lying on a hospital bed, for instance. So the message there is that it's more costly to treat somebody in a hospital setting than somebody who's not in a dissimilar setting. So here we try to depict because now we've just indicated that a lot of the benefits expenditure goes towards hospitals. But I'm depicting here the admission rate per 1,000 beneficiaries in 2018. A lot of admissions, about 19%, were medical cases, 9% were surgical cases, and then 3% were maternity cases. In the main, what you see in medical cases, for instance, is the instances whereby the driver there is people who get admitted for pneumonia. It's really a big thing in the medical skin sector. And then secondly, that you find cases like your knee replacement. Those are some of the cases that you see. For surgical cases, you see cases like a cesarean section rate, which is really one of the highest in the country, but it's one of the contributing factors for surgical cases. And then also here, we also depict the average length of stay. For medical case, the average length of stay is 5 days, and then for your surgical cases, it's 3 days. For maternity cases, it's 2.9. Obviously, this is averages. It will differ by benefit design by medical scheme. So you might find for some medical scheme is slightly higher than the 2.9, for instance, depending on the richness of benefits. So the other issue, SEMES also contributes to the SDG, the Sustainable Development Goals, in terms of where we work closely with SENEC. We collect data, the HIV data in the private sector, and they mirror that with the public sector that they report to the World Health Organization. But what we see HIV has become one of the most prevalent conditions in the medical scheme sector. Previously, ordinarily, you have hypertension is number one, most prevalent. Second to that is diabetes type 2, hyperlipidemia, and then number three is your diabetes type 2. But now what we see that HIV is catching up fast. It's going to be, in the near future, it's going to be maybe the third most prevalent condition. With regards to some of the data that we've collected also last year, what we see really an improvement, because if you look at the number of people or the percentage of people that get access to ARV treatment, it has increased by 3%, which is really a good story to tell, because it means there is now access to care. So in terms of the conclusion, that some of, based on the what we see really indeed, it is a challenging industry in terms of growth, in terms of number of people, in terms of number of people who are entering or getting enrolled by the medical schemes. As I indicated, that the growth has been below 1% over time. I mean, on a year-to-year basis. But the other challenge that is facing the sector is the increased burden of disease, like the story that I told around HIV, as well as hypertension and other types of conditions. So we really see an increase in the burden of disease of members of medical schemes, and we know that they are quite expensive. And then also, I also depicted that the weighted average age is increasing of medical scheme members. But the concerning issue is really the cost containment, where we see really, the average cost on a year-to-year basis is higher than inflation, so it means healthcare is becoming more and more expensive, even for medical scheme members, as well as the increasing out-of-pocket payment expenditure, both at benefits paid by the member directly from their pockets and those that are coming directly from the savings pool. So there's also an issue where there needs to be an improvement in terms of benefit design, so that it focuses more on primary health care, preventing people from landing in a hospital bed, because we know that it's very expensive to treat someone at hospital setting. And then, yeah, so that is it from my side in the main. My chairperson is just reminding me that I must state my name. My name is Michael Willy. I'm in the research and, research and monitoring division at CNS. Thank you.
Chairperson and honourable members of Parliament. My name is Elizabeth Figueredo and I'm with the CMS Financial Supervision Unit. I'm one of the senior financial analysts and it's my honour to present the financial performance of the medical schemes that we've seen for 2018. So just in the outline of my presentation, you can also view it on pages 174 to 233 in the annual report. We're going to just look at a quick snapshot of the industry, the contributions and claims, non-healthcare expenditure, some of the scheme's results, solvency, and then administrator market share. You'll note that the CMS financial year is actually 1 April to 31 March, and that there's a mismatch between that and the scheme's financial year, which is 1 January to 31 December. According to Section 37 of the MSA, it requires submission of annual financial statements by all medical schemes within 4 months. So we should receive it at our offices by the end of April of each year for the previous financial year. Just a snapshot of the industry. What's very important to note here is that the solvency here is just above 34, which is above the required prescribed minimum solvency requirement of 25% for all schemes. On the contribution side, we have gross contributions of $192.3 billion for all schemes, and then risk contributions of $174 billion. The difference between gross and risk contributions is also what Michael alluded to, the fact that we have savings contributions as well. So the difference between risk contributions and that there's a separate savings component included in our total contribution that gets paid to the medical scheme. And that's the difference between the two. In terms of risk contributions, the per life per member per month is $1,633.91. And those are the increases from 2017 to 2018. Then you'll see the trends in contributions. You'll see that there's generally an upward trend in contributions. And this is based on 2018 prices, so this has been adjusted for inflation. So we see that this continues to increase in line with the fact that our claims are also increasing. If you look at the claims incurred, the gross claims is $174 billion, and risk claims is $156.9 billion. On a per life basis, it's $1,474 per average beneficiary per month. And this also translates to 90% of total contributions that are being received went towards relevant healthcare services, so towards claims that have been paid out of medical schemes. If we look at our trends in claims, it was also a general upward trend. This has also been adjusted for inflation. Michael also alluded to some of the reasons for this, which is mainly utilization, demographic profile, aging of those of the demographic profile. In looking at the distribution of risk contributions, this pie chart just indicates to us the rand value for 1 rand. So 91 cents would have been paid out to claims, and 9 cents of it would have been paid out to non-healthcare expenditure. If we look at the relationship between claims and contributions, you'll see that specifically in 2014, if you look on the trend line, 2004, you would have seen that due to the deregulation of the prices in that year. And if you focus on the 2017 to 2018, you would see that there would have been an increase in the claims ratio. That increase is mainly due to the increases in claims that we've experienced, which we've already mentioned is due to higher utilization and increase in prices. Then if we look at the distribution of non-healthcare expenditure, you will see the blue indicates administration expenditure, and that takes up the bulk of the amount of non-healthcare expenditure. The green indicates broker fees and distribution costs. If we look at our trends in non-healthcare expenditure, you will see that there is a general downward trend, although managed care managed services have now sort of been moved up from 2014-2015 into the claims line. So you would have seen a dip there in 2015. But in general, there is a downward trend. And then in looking at the schemes with the highest principal officer fees, you'll see there's a number of schemes that have high PO fees, but there's not really a correlation between the size of the scheme and the amount of that principal officers get paid. If we look at the schemes with the highest trustee remuneration, you'll see that there's also not really a correlation between the size of the scheme and how many trustees there are. But in terms of the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill, there is actually something that has been added in where we will be able to look at the, it will provide for the determination of the parameters to be applied in the determination of remuneration for those POs and trustees. When we look at the net healthcare results and the net surplus, you'll see the blue line at the bottom is our net healthcare results. And this is basically the operational results. And you'll see the green line is the net surplus, and this is after investment income. So you can see that medical schemes rely heavily on investment income in order to generate profits for the schemes as a whole. You'll see that in 2018, the net surplus has decreased from 2017 to 2018, and that's mainly due to claims. One of the reasons for that is also due to lower investment income that was also experienced in 2018 industry-wide. Then to look at the solvency trends, you'll see for the bold blue line, it still remains above 25%, which is the required solvency level that's required for all medical schemes. And then you'll see there's a slight increase on the light blue line for the restricted schemes industry average, and that's mainly due to the fact that the government employees medical schemes results improved significantly. Then just to take a look at the prescribed solvency and the number of beneficiaries, this is basically a monitoring of schemes that falling below the 25% solvency requirement. In 2017, you will see that the number of schemes that were below the prescribed level, there were 6, and in 2018, there were 7 medical schemes that were below the 25%, which is what we constantly monitor, and we have meetings with these medical schemes, and they are under strict monitoring by ourselves. Then, just to quickly take a look at the scheme investments, you'll notice that the majority of scheme investments are invested in cash and bonds, and this is due to the short-term nature of having to pay out claims. So you'll see majority of them are in cash and bonds, and this also assists with the liquidity requirements that all medical schemes need. And you'll see that there are other investments in properties and equities as well, which helps for a bit of diversification within the for the scheme investments. And then lastly, just to look at the administrator market share of all schemes, you'll notice that there's actually 4 dominant players, being Discovery Health, Med Scheme Holdings, Metropolitan, and MMI Health, which are basically dominating the market in terms of administrators. So in conclusion, we'll see that you would have also seen in Michael's presentation that healthcare costs continue to rise, and that for the financial period ended 31 December 2018 was a challenging year for schemes, and that's mainly due to the increase in claims, utilization, and we saw a lot of high cost cases coming through. The rates of increase in the NH in non-health expenditure is stable, albeit in total still too high. Fraud, waste, and abuse still remains a concern for us. Circular 6 of 2019, which was issued, allows us to unbundle the reporting of specific administration expenditure, which will help us to compare medical schemes more accurately, that type of expenditure. So there'll be classification and reporting on those services, which will help us to compare medical schemes administration. And that schemes are investing mostly in cash and bonds, which is in line with their high liquidity requirements, and that medical schemes continue to rely on investment income to boost their financial performance. But overall solvency for all schemes still remains above 25%. And that's all from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairperson. Good afternoon to members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Mamsi Mashilo. I'm in the Complaints Adjudication Unit in the Council for Medical Schemes. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you the complaint trends and the performance of the Complaints Adjudication Unit over the 2018 year under review. My presentation is quite short, so I will take you through the complaints resolution and as well as the resolution turnaround time. I'll also take you through the rulings that we have issued in terms of open medical schemes and restricted medical schemes respectively, as well as the complaints resolved per category. And we'll also look at the key observations that we've picked up in adjudication of complaints and the issues relating to underperformance and the backlog and how we are addressing it, as Dr. Kabane had earlier on indicated that there is a backlog. Basically, this slide just indicates that it shows the volumes that we have dealt with over the years, as well as the numbers that we carry over year on year, and this also helps to explain the backlog that the unit is dealing with. As indicated earlier, the unit has capacity constraints, but we have been working very hard to try and reduce the backlog. It also indicates that in the 2018, in the year under review, 4,758 complaints were resolved out of a total of 6,650, which is a combination of what we had carried over and what had come in the year 2018. The main reason for carrying these matters over, as indicated, is issues pertaining to aging of complaints that would, at the end of the year, still be open. And this is mainly due to issues like capacity constraints, but measures have been put in place to address those. In 2018, the office had also assisted in the appointment of temporary paralegals who helped significantly with the back and forth administrative staff. And by doing so, that managed to free up the legal adjudicators to attend to the cases. But what we also need to point out is that there is always a need to balance between the older cases and the current cases because if one focuses mainly on the backlog, the older cases also tend to create a new backlog. So we try and balance between the two, which is something that we endeavor to show significant improvement in. The next slide shows a breakdown in terms of the turnaround times. It shows a breakdown in terms of the 0 to 30 days, complaints which were resolved within 31 to 60 days, 61 to 90 days, 90 to 120 working days, because our turnaround time is 120 working days. So all complaints which have not been resolved within the 120 working days are the ones that will be regarded as the backlog. And it shows the total that was resolved in 2018 as 4,578 complaints. In this slide, we show a depiction of the rulings which were issued by the Office of the Registrar. And what it shows there is that 1,146 of these rulings were issued in favor of complainants, whereas the 1,187 were issued in favor of regulated entities. And then we have a split where there are rulings which were issued in favor of both complainants and the regulated entities. But what the slide also shows is that there is a fair balance in terms of the rulings that are issued by the office. The office is governed mainly by the provisions of the Medical Schemes Act and the rules of the medical schemes, and we endeavor at all times to ensure that the rulings that we issue are fair and are within the prescripts of the law. But one thing also that needs to be noted is that whenever rulings are issued in favor of the regulated entities, it also needs to be kept in mind that it is still within our mandate as we aim to protect the interests of beneficiaries, and that does not only mean the person that is complaining but also the membership collective in general. So in terms of the open medical schemes, those are the figures, and when you look at the restricted medical schemes, you can see that there is a significant amount of rulings which were issued in favor of complainants, which is 1,081 rulings issued. 491 of those were issued in favor of medical schemes, and the split, as you can see, there is 232 of those rulings. The smaller amount relates to, you know, inquiries where those matters were handled at the office and resolved at that point. The complaints resolved per category, you will see that 2,224, which is 55% of those, of the overall complaints resolved, were in respect of the broader administrative complaints. And this would relate to your incorrect claim processing, complaints relating to contribution increases, benefit option increases, where maybe members had submitted complaints because they were not allowed to change benefit options during the course of the year. So those are the types of complaints that take the big chunk there. The slide also shows that there is a need for more member-focused interventions where members need to be educated. However, these are, you know, interventions that we encourage medical schemes to undertake, and the office also does the same in terms of the outreach programs that we do. The second large group of category of complaints relates to clinical complaints, where you can see that 1,430 of the complaints resolved in 2018 related to clinical issues or clinical natured complaints. And this would be your short payment of PMB conditions, your clinical coding issues, other types of complaints, it's PMB short payments, either due to protocols not being observed or formularies. So those are the type of complaints that we classify as clinical complaints. The key observations that we've made in resolution of complaints in the past year is that there is insufficient communication of benefit entitlements, and there is room there for interventions which can be made to make sure that members are adequately protected. There is also lack of member education at scheme level, and we undertake interventions on a regular basis to encourage medical schemes to increase the communication and education of members at that level. The complexity of the benefit design is also something that has been alluded to, and we also see it where the end result is that members don't quite understand the benefits that they are entitled to, and there is quite a lot of information, so members don't understand how to navigate their benefits and how to best utilize them with less expenses coming out of their pockets. We've also noted that there is member apathy, where members sort of become indifferent because of the complexity of the environment, where most of the things they don't understand. They tend to sort of shrug it off because there really isn't anything in their view that they can do. And we see that in the sentiments that they express in the complaints. So this is something that we have also picked up. Non-compliance of PMB regulations is something that we also pick up, as you will note in the slide, in the annual report. There is a breakdown of the number of complaints per category, and it depicts the percentage increase in those types of complaints that has also seemed to go up. There's also a misinterpretation of benefits by some healthcare providers, because we also receive a lot of complaints from healthcare providers who act on behalf of members. But the misinterpretation, you can actually see that it's where they inadvertently maybe would inform a member that their condition should be funded in full. But when you go to the scheme rules, obviously because healthcare providers don't have access to the rules, there might be, the rules might make a different provision for that. So that is something that we see, but there's actual engagement. We also encourage medical schemes to create a channel of communication with healthcare providers. So provide them with protocols and formularies so healthcare providers will also understand, as they treat members, the type of entitlements that members have. And lastly, what we've also picked up is members don't seem to understand the DSP arrangement. This is designated service providers. It's healthcare providers with whom medical schemes would contract and restrict members to obtain services from those service providers in order for them not to incur co-payments. So we still see members incurring co-payments in that regard, and this leads us to the view that members don't quite understand how to navigate that, and there is more need for education in that, for members to be educated in that regard, and also for medical schemes to take the responsibility and ensure that there is an even spread and of designated service providers within reasonable proximity. The last slide, owing to what we have already admitted to in terms of the backlog, just seeks to show the interventions that we have implemented at the office to deal with the backlog and ensure that there is active intervention, that we don't just leave it to grow. So in the current interventions included the appointment of paralegals, as indicated. It also included filling of an additional adjudicator position, which was filled this year. Although there is high staff turnover, there is active commitment within the unit to actually work on reducing the backlog. And I think as we stand, we're looking at a very marked improvement in that regard. Other interventions would include a new IT system, which will reduce the administrative interventions, which actually now have to be made manually, thus saving time to deal with the actual adjudication of these complaints. Other interventions will also include realignment of the processes to make sure that the process is not administratively cumbersome, and to also make sure that there is always, because there's always cases that get carried over, that you have an even split between adjudicators who deal with a backlog and adjudicators who deal with current cases to make sure that the current cases also don't fall into the backlog. The other interventions that we're looking at is to actually, on an ongoing basis, do an audit and document the backlog as we go, so that we, at any given time, we know what we are dealing with, we know how much of it, and we know what we need to do to intervene and to sort of make sure that we manage it, that it does not run away from us. Also, the allocation of dedicated resources or dedicated individuals to deal with the backlog. We tried it in 2018, and it seemed to yield positive results. So that we are hopeful that going forward it will yield an improvement. Thank you very much.
That was the last slide. Dr. Mini, I was not aware that Dr. Kabane is this organized, but I think it's because he's surrounded by a lot of very dedicated women. He seems to be very organized this time. Last time I was with him, he was not this well organized. Congratulations. There's an improvement. Thank you very much.
There were too many men around him that time. Last time.
I suppose so.
Chair, please allow me to introduce two council members who are at the back there. I know you'll meet them with the rest of the council when you visit us on a date that I'm sure Vuyogaz is working on. With the invitation still stands. The lady who adds to the ladies that we brought here is Miss Musidi Mabuye on the left, and then on the right is Mr. Mwerane Maimane. He's not related to anyone you may know. Those are the two council members.
Thank you very much for that. Firstly, the presentation was very organized, free-flowing, able to follow what we are dealing with, well-sectioned in a way. I really found it extremely interesting to go through. I hope my members will then be able to direct their clarification, questions, comments well. Yeah, no, we do see that you are doing very well in your financials. Financial report has already been also commended by AG. Not very usual you get AG commenting and positively so, but please, whatever that you are doing that makes you to achieve what you are doing with AG, continue and even do better. Because we are scraping the pot in the country looking for entities that are able to look after resources without thinking that the money is there for them to dig into. Money is meant to do what it is meant to do, and that's all. Usually these are well-paid individuals who find it easy to go and dig money into these wrong spaces. I've always said this in the other place where I said, you know, supply chain, these people go to school and learn how to do supply chain management. But when they go to work, they do a different thing. They do something which is not what is meant to be done. And that's where, because you don't take ordinary grandmothers to go and manage finances of this institution. You take people who apply because they are well educated, but they do the opposite. They do what even grandmothers can't do on a stock fell. And therefore we lose so much money. But anyway, let me give space to the members who want to interact with your presentation. I'll see by show of hands, members. You're tired now. Don't look tired. Okay, they are fresh. Ladies are fresh. Look at the ladies. That is over okay. Did you sign the register? Oh, she has signed. Okay. I'll start with you because you are much fresher. I don't know where you have been. Maybe you have been working hard in the other committees. That's here. Yeah. Honorable Chirwa, Honorable Shlengwa, Honorable, in that order, Honorable Janti, Honorable Jacobs, and then Honorable Fine Starter. Thank you. Starch.
Thank you, Chair. I firstly want to say thank you for a very well-presented presentation. We appreciate that. My question really is just on page 36 around the lease. I'm not sure if I remember correctly, but there was mention of a new building. Was it not for this? No. I just want to find out the lease. Is there a reason why it is a lease and why not we're not acquiring our own assets? Because what we have found, what I found in the previous presentations as well, not for this committee but for others, is that a lot of money is being wasted out of the state coffers into rentals that can really, you know, increase our asset register and our capital. So I just want to, if I can get clarity on that. The amount of complaints that was recorded, is it that South Africans really do not make use of the channels that is available to them? Is it a case of awareness that we maybe need to drive more awareness around people being able to take up the issues that they have within medical schemes? Because it seems as if, it is a trend that people are not really empowered to deal with issues that they have within medical schemes. Then I just need, it's a clarifying question, really, the 10.8 million deficit. I take it that was a surplus and that it needed to be given back to Treasury. Am I right about that? Yeah.
I'll explain that.
Yeah.
I'm noting the question.
Yeah. And that is it from my side, Dr. Tlomo.
Thank you, Chip. Thanks for the presentation. I have a few questions. Yeah. I want to check with the minister last time in the assembly spoke about the. Remember, you guys told about the 4 million that's needed for the SIU to do this investigation on racial profiling. The minister came to tell us that. The money was released or that it's going to happen or something like that. So I want to follow up and check if this is the case and if it is, how far along it is and what's going on with that issue. Number two, I want to know what will happen to the reserves in the CMS when the NHI is rolled in and what the role of the CMS will be in the implementation of the NHI. And a point for concern for me here is for the members of open schemes on the out-of-pocket payments. I think it's too high, especially when we consider the fact that with the cases that are resolved in favor of the schemes is also relatively high. So I think there is definitely room for concern there. Because it means one of the two is not represented properly by the CMS, and obviously in this case, I think it is the members of open schemes. And what then? How do we remedy this? Like, is there a standardized criteria that could be implemented to root out exploitation, or to monitor from inside the CMS? On what could be the reason why there's a lot of complaints and out-of-pocket payments by open scheme people, but the complaints that are lodged are ruled in favor of the medical aid schemes. With public engagements, are there like activities or programs that are implemented by the CMS that engage with the public? If there are, please enlighten us on those and what the impact and effectiveness of those are, because it's not here in what you presented today. Thank you.
Before Umama Ushengwa, this is not in reference to Honorable Chirwa. Let's look at this again you could look into it, because they have been well-answered questions. I love them. I wish I could keep them for life, because they are so educational. So maybe if we need, let us not be tempted, members who are remaining behind, to raise questions. Not that the ones that have raised questions for me. I'm just raising this document. We have received it yesterday. And once you lost your you can't get into a plane when the doors were closed. I give you that space here because we are pusher. Anyway, so back if it's too late, you're better now. And that was what I get because we're late. The ladies, I always go out and come back, go out and come back. No, no, I'm just pulling a leg. There is an emergency that she was really dealing with this morning, and I'm aware of that emergency. So it will take her in and out. So you will come after Honorable Van Staden.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the report. It was so clear and followed very clear. Thank you for that. Mine is just clarity. Yes, clarity. Let me have a clear clarity when we are talking about stakeholder training. Who are those stakeholders getting training, receiving training, seeking for clarity there? Number two, I see that GEM were the part of this medical scheme. All of the GEM's people were just crying, some are resigning because GEMs are just cut off just before June. Even myself, where I was a teacher, they just cut off before June. Why? Lastly, here there is a sentence, an oversight, that complex benefits design and information overload. Is there any awareness to the members that they can get some benefits when they resign? Is there any awareness of that? If no, why? If yes, when and how? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Honorable Chira asked the question that I was going to ask, but I was going to ask, what does CMS think of this, that why are the regulated medical schemes benefiting in the complaint more than us who are in the open medical scheme? What do you think is the reason for that? Then a second question I'm going to ask, which I was asked because I'm a member of parliament, by somebody who says he's been in the scheme for more than 10 years. He's retired. Are there no benefits for people who have retired from medical schemes? Like he was saying, he had to pay out of the pocket. Says, but that can't happen. I've been in this scheme for more than 10 years. They know I'm over 65. Why can't they do me a favor? I couldn't answer that question. But I know how painful it is for you to pay out of your pocket, from experience, that you have to pay out of your pocket, and you know that you are paying so much money. I'm surprised that
my scheme, our scheme is not yet amongst the it's not mentioned here. Why is it not mentioned? And yet it should be amongst the top five.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I have about 4 points I want to raise. Not so long ago in the news, we read about the increases which the medical aides will be levying on the members of the medical aides. And I think if I remember, somewhere between 8 and 9%, if I remember correctly, Discovery was at 9.8%. And it was quite shocking to read. Now, understanding the role of the Council for the Medical Schemes, that in their own words, they provide guidance to the medical schemes with regards to their annual increases, I would like to see you mention to us what you have done in trying to curb that. It's quite large if you consider inflation and you consider also our economic situation currently in the country. So we need an intervention there on those increases. And I hope that ParaMed is also not going towards 8 or 9% since the Honorable Member just mentioned ParaMed here next to me. The second one is on the complaints. Now, when you say complaints, you're not saying who has complaints. So I would assume that those complaints are the complaints from members of contributors to the medical aid, to the medical aids or the medical schemes. Because it could be individuals, it could be the members, it could be healthcare practitioners, it could be the medical schemes themselves who raise complaints with you. So maybe we need that to be clarified. So as we go to slide 90, which is on your complaints resolution, if I look January to December 2016 and I do the figures there, then I realize about 1,800 were carried over, which you call a backlog. And then the next year you have another 3,900 carried over, and the next year we have another 2,000 carried over. But it's not mentioned in the following years. So those figures would probably then look quite different if it was added, that which is resolved and those which are not resolved added to the year following. So I'm not certain whether I'm not understanding this correctly. And then number three, the increased financial needs of the council for the medical schemes themselves, yourselves. It's an important thing because of the work that you're doing in regulating what the medical schemes do. And so we understand that you need more income. One point raised is that maybe the principal members from the levies, either the levies from the medical schemes or increased payment by the principal members. Now, we're already looking at huge increases, into the annual increases, so maybe we need a bit of assistance from you so that we can see how we can also assist you in reaching those targets that you require. And number four, we understand medical schemes to be not-for-profit organizations. And I mentioned this before, we have seen what they do. Is they do take the money, and as you had rightly put it, they put it into the administration arm, and they put it into owning buildings, as capital assets, etc. And in that way, obviously, building up the huge reserves. So could those reserves, for argument's sake, not be used towards the needs that the CMS has? And what will happen to those reserves in the future as the NHI gets implemented? You see, I am concerned, and knowing generally human attitude, we need to make certain that those reserves do not slowly become less and less over the next 10 years. So you need to keep a close eye on those reserves and where it goes in the next 10 years as we're going towards the NHI. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Yeah, on the backlogs and the complaints, I assume it's an administrative issue, but I just want to know why did this happen and from what date is this backlog running. And then I also want to know about the reserves in the medical age, when the introduction of the NHI is coming to life. And we read in the newspapers all sort of things about your council, members being suspended and so on and so on. Can you please just explain to us what happened, so that we know out of horse's mouth what happened and what the reason therefore was and what sort of amounts we're talking about. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I've got about three questions. Understanding that the council's role or mandate is one, regulatory, and number two, informing the public. I understand that the chairperson had mentioned that the HMI report will be tabled here in due course, but I think it would be amiss if we'd, because I think some of the issues that were raised in the HMI report are in fact have been by your own admission in your presentation. So I just want to understand, one of the scathing findings of the report was that the rising cost of co-payments, which you had mentioned, overpricing and over-servicing. So I just want to understand, because ultimately the regulatory arm of the department is somehow devolved to you as a council. And so what role have you played over the past 2.5 decades in ensuring that as part of your mandate, which obviously is from how you were founded, have you ensured that you have regulated the private healthcare sector enough so that we can curb the rising costs of medical care, as you've said, the rising cost of co-payments, overpricing, and what measures do you have in place to look into issues around over-servicing? I looked at one of your stats talking about some of the cases around surgical cases. We're looking at about 92%, and you, by your own admission, that is due to a high number of C-sections. And we know for a fact that there is a problem of medical hospital groups essentially opting to give people C-sections and natural births because of a profit motivation. So what has the CMS done in this regard to curb some of these things that have reared their ugly heads? Because I think it would be amiss to not ask the question in the climate of this HMI report. Then the second thing is, it just relates to one of your revenue sources. I note that majority of your revenue sources comes from medical aid contributions. Now, in the introduction of NHI, we are not quite clear what the role of medical schemes is going to be. And even the last time when you guys were here, you were still also unclear with your engagements with the department what the role of medical aid schemes is going to be. So, what is then the future of the CMS in this regard? Have you gotten clarity from the department on whether or not, is there any viability to the CMS? Because if majority of your revenue comes from medical aid contributions, and that is a dwindling number of people, how are you going to keep afloat? And what are we going to do in the future with the people who are still part of medical schemes? Then my last question is the Medical Schemes Act. I've received a number of complaints from people talking about the outdated nature of some of the PMBs. Is there work that has been done to look into that and updating those to ensure that they cover a lot more people in a lot more instances? Because there are still medical schemes that are excluding people on arbitrary basis, and also basing that on legislation that was passed in 1997. So surely there is now a need after decades to update those regulations or update the legislation. Is there work that has been done? Is the CMS seized with that? And are some of the complaints that you are getting, are you seeing that it's because of loopholes that have been created by outdated legislation or not? Thanks.
very much. I would really request that maybe some of the things, my question would be to amplify some of the things from Kwahube, but maybe just check if our answer number 3 does not touch on some of the things that is bothering there. What will be the future of Council for Medical Schemes be, and what will be the business model of the scheme be? Something related to that. I'm going to ask my question from the back of the presentation, starting with a conclusion on page 65, on slide 65. It's something basic, because you would want to understand, not because you're a parliamentarian who's understanding things, but you want to understand it in the way you always explain it to someone else out there. In the conclusion, they were saying increase in out-of-pocket expenditure is a concern. It's a statement made by the presentation. Now, why is that a concern? What causes this out-of-pocket expenditure? How will it go to end? It's bothering on Honorable Shengwa to say certain medical schemes you are part of, they tell you we are aware that you are still unwell. It's in August. You don't have money anymore in your progress. So just see how you get treated. If you think that your illness is that serious, go look for money elsewhere. But you just don't have money to look after you. Now, that's probably one of the things we define as out of pocket. So if you don't have any, if your pocket is empty, what do you do? Maybe you don't come to assist us there, but it's important that we know that those individual South Africans, that they must fight on their own. Slide number 61. I wrote here in my own handwriting what I was listening to. I don't know whether I was correct, that health is more expensive if you seek it in hospital than in a primary health care. Someone was motivating on the primary health care. Helped me to understand that, because that was my own thinking when we were explaining it, that I wrote it in my handwriting. So someone helped me there. Slide number 59. I think slide number 59 is the mother of all slides. Please assist me to understand it. I don't want to say what it is, but what I see there, benefits paid per discipline. Now, please take me steadily on this understanding, because I want to say I've been part of this meeting and I understand this slide so well that I can be able to explain to someone else there. I hope, was it you presenting? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me just plead with you. I think one of the things that made me not to understand somehow some of the slides were a bit faster. And just talk to a layman like me when you answer this question. So I think I was left out of. So those are my main areas where I needed to be assisted. And then thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. I'm going to be assisted by my colleague here in some of these slides. In other words, all matters financial will be dealt with by Cindy, and Mamsi will deal with all the complaints. But I think a number of the issues raised by the chairperson fall directly under Michael's domain. But just to touch on a few issues that have been raised, I will start with the cost of the SIU investigation, which we estimate at about 4.6. The SIU investigation has got nothing to do with the allegations of racial profiling. There's a separate investigation which we're calling a Section 59 investigation, and that's the one that is being carried out by an independent panel led by Advocate Mugai Tobia. And the estimates at this point of the cost of that investigation are around 10 million. But just to add to the burden in terms of cost, part of what has been asked here, the additional investigations, you know, that were going to be carrying out on the basis that certain employees at CMS have now been placed on suspension, will certainly add to that 14.6 million. At this stage, you know, we do not have an estimate. But just to also cover this area that has been cited by many honorable members, and this is the question of the reserves in schemes. This is one of the areas that still need to be revisited by all key stakeholders under the leadership of the national minister. Because currently, if you look at what the NHI bill is saying, it says that full implementation of the NHI schemes will now be providing what is known as complementary cover, or what the NHI fund will be excluding from its benefit basket. Now, the details of how we migrate from the current dispensation to that full implementation is the detail that still needs to be worked out. And that transition from the current to the NHI environment needs to address this question of the current reserves. Current reserves are actually generated by what remains after contributions have been used to pay for services. And these accumulate on an annual basis. If you ask members of schemes, they will tell you that it is their money. If you talk to other people, they will say it's a much more complex problem than that. Given the fact that government, you know, through tax credits and subsidies, also make a contribution there. So now, how do you disaggregate, you know, the collective reserves in order to be able to say this portion belongs to A, B, and C? And remember, even these employers will also say we make contribution to these reserves for some of the schemes here, that without any, you know, employer contributions would not be financially viable. So I think it's something that needs to be addressed. We need to get the technical experts to look at that. And at this stage, I would, you know, reserve my comment in terms of how these would be disposed of here. Because it's a matter that needs to be consulted with all the key stakeholders. There is also this issue of the role of the schemes and CMS. And Chairperson, we did, you know, make reference to it in the, you know, the Q&A of the previous. But just to reiterate, at this stage, where we are sitting is, the minister has said to us here, the key priority right now is to deal with the bill and the legislation. There will be a parallel process where all the affected stakeholders, including CMS, the industry, where they will sit down and say, how do we negotiate, you know, this transition between now and that point when the NHI funds, you know, basically makes it compulsory for all of us to be part of the NHI. And that transition needs to be worked out. From where we sit as CMS, we are saying we regulate in terms of the any legislation that, you know, is placed in front of us. Currently, we are sitting with the Medical Schemes Act 131 of 1998. And basically, we'll continue legislating using that piece of legislation until that has been amended. In the pipeline, there's a Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. This is a bill that was released for public comment at the same time as the NHI last year in July. And National Minister has been receiving comments in terms of the public input. The reason we're told the NHI bill was, you know, pushed further and ours delayed a bit was because the implementation of the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill has to incorporate some of the recommendations that are coming from the health market inquiry. So as we sit, we are seized with a, you know, repackaging that medical schemes amendment bill to firstly address any regulatory shortfalls that we have been experiencing with the current act. And that includes, you know, the delays in the PMB review and all of those related issues. But we've been also giving a lot of schemes and administrators exemptions when in fact we could fix this by making the appropriate, you know, regulations. But we are also looking at, apart from the health market inquiry, the NHI bill itself already suggests certain amendments that need to be effected onto the medical schemes amendment bill. Because it says you don't have to wait until you reach that point of full implementation for you to talk about this complementary cover. It's something that can be included right now, so that when it happens, there's no need for a legislation change. But, Chairperson, there's also an anticipated recommendations on the Section 59 investigation on racial profiling. We believe that it will change the way Section 59 is written and understood. So all of those changes we're going to incorporate into this bill, which we're hoping will be entertained immediately following the disposal of the NHI bill. And we hope that it will also take into account the kind of changes, you know, in the mandate of CMS, the business model of schemes as they move from the current dispensation forward. So on the question of whether CMS is, you know, seized with reviewing things like PMBs because of the aged legislation, yes, indeed, we have started a process as early as 2016, and we're reviewing PMBs, and we're moving away from the current list of diagnostic and treatment pairs, as well as chronic diseases list, because, in fact, the criticism is there's no rigorous methodology that was followed in including or excluding certain conditions from that PMB basket. So together with the industry, meaning schemes, administrators, beneficiaries themselves, we have been dealing with that. And currently, the priority is almost aligned with what the HMI is also recommending, of a standardized single option that will cut across schemes. Now, if you add the primary health care element to that, you'd almost theoretically say that we have moved from this disease list, you've now come with a package that is comprehensive and indeed may form a basis of what the NHI package may look like. So this is the current thinking. So when we say this is the package that we've now reviewed and we're presenting, it will look completely different from the current list. And we're aware of all the shortfalls of the current PMB, that they are hospice-centric, costly, there's no gatekeeping, they are not in line with the burden of disease, and basically they are meant to, you know, currently service providers and hospitals are taking advantage of the way they are currently structured to make the profits that they are currently making. I think the issue of the lease, I'm going to leave to Cindy. But the main point that I just wanted to make around the out-of-pocket expenses, Chairperson and honorable members, currently we are underestimating this figure, because what we are presenting to you is actually based on claims that have been rejected by schemes. There are those claims that many of us elect not even to, you know, to produce and give to schemes, because you know it's an administrative nightmare. There's also the apathy that all of us are probably guilty of. When you buy a penicillin, the scheme pays maybe 70 rands, and the pharmacy says, give us 25. and you think you don't want to get into trouble of trying to claim that 25. Now, these are the amounts that are not accounted for in these figures. What we are told by WHO here is that out-of-pocket payments need to be eliminated completely because they contribute towards the impoverization of members of scheme and indeed even their dependents. There are cases, you know, you may think these out-of-pockets, it's just that 40, 50 rands, but in some instances, people undergo major, procedures, and they are sitting with bills, sometimes more than a million, and they have to, you know, dispose of some of their assets in order to meet with the bills. Remember also, related to Section 59, if your service providers are not paid by schemes and administrators, they go after the patient. So, in my view, this is a huge underestimation of a major problem. But I think what is being presented as a solution to this here, the mandatory membership into the NHI, the free of services at the point of care, means that if you're a member of a universal health coverage like the NHI, you don't have to worry about co-payments. Because these are dealt with at a certain level. I'm going to also ask Grace, after you know other people have spoken, to talk about the public engagements in terms of what is being done, is it effective, who are these people that are being engaged, and also around stakeholder training. But just to say a little bit about the reason why people run out of funds. It's a multiplicity of factors. Firstly, because there are so many benefit options in the industry, they are in excess of 200, making rational choices about what is appropriate for yourself is a problem. Now, this means you're buying a product who at the time when you need it may actually cost you more. You may also be buying a benefit option that is not aligned to your state of health. So you find that you go more frequently, but you've invested in a low-cost option or a basic option, and as a result, you know, you exhaust this. But there's also an element of, users of schemes looking at this as a grudge purchase, where people say, I'm contributing every month, so I must make sure that I get value for my money. Now, when you do that, but you don't watch the statements that are coming back from schemes that actually demonstrate how much of your benefits are remaining, then you run into the problem of the funds being exhausted. But Chairperson and honorable members, there is an element of fraud, waste, and abuse, where people give member cards to their relatives, where people buy groceries and other non-healthcare services and goods using a medical aid. Now, obviously, if you abuse your medical aid, it will run out. But I think, Chairperson, there's also the lack of understanding of the rules of the schemes. I think schemes at this stage make the rules so complex that an ordinary person is unable to make out where your entitlement starts and where they end. So there's always that problem. And I think I've tried to explain the gems, but I think my colleagues can add. Now, we've also been asked here, what has CMS been doing over the past years to address issues of co-payments, you know, overpricing, in fact, all of the issues that are being raised by the Health Market Inquiry. I think the point that I want to make is there's actually a gap in the regulatory environment of health. Firstly, CMS is only mandated to regulate schemes, administrators, managed care organizations, as well as brokers. The regulation of professionals sits with the Health Professions Council of South Africa that makes sure that they behave in an ethical, you know, and professional manner. The hospitals, you know, your private hospitals, are largely unregulated. And we have shown statistics here that that Michael showed, that if you look at the pie, if you want to call it, of where the money that the contributions that we all make is going to, a huge percentage of that, I think 37%, goes to hospitals. And this is the area that is unregulated. The second part goes to medicines, advanced specialists, etc. So in a sense, the biggest area in the market that is under-regulated is where most of the resources end up here. So and currently, I think what the Health Market Inquiry is proposing is a new regulator called the Supply Side Regulator. And it is precisely aimed at looking at managing and regulating these facilities, not only in terms of the prices that they may charge, but also in terms of licensing and saying, in a province, how many beds should actually be allocated to the private sector? And where should these be located? Should these be in the urban areas? Or should you try and spread them around, you know, to ensure that there's proper access? So yes, indeed, some of the recommendations are aimed at trying to address the gaps. But the role of CMS here, and I think my colleague Paresh will talk to this here. Part of the areas where there's not much regulation happening is in the fraud, waste, and abuse, where you find that there's over-servicing, there's over-pricing of products, etc. And we as CMS, for instance, have seen this as a major problem. I think we were on record to saying that up to 22 billion of the claims that are processed annually of schemes are associated with some fraud, waste, and abuse. And part of it, it's the lack of rules. In other words, there's no agreement between schemes, administrators, the CMS, patients, on how to behave around your medical scheme. But we've had the summit in February and March this year, where we were able to sit with the industry and actually develop the charter. We developed a set of a common understanding of the definitions. And in the follow-up summit that we're going to have in the new year, we're going to be looking at the codes of best practice. And this will talk to how patients should conduct themselves if they are members of schemes, because they are also part of the problem. There's collusion. We're also going to talk to the providers of the services. We're going to talk to the schemes. We're going to talk to the administrators. But we think what also will come as recommendations from the Section 59 investigation on the racial profiling and billing issues will contribute towards providing a sustainable solution here. Chairperson, I just wanted to correct something here. The funding that CMS gets here is mainly levies. I think these account for something like 87% of the funding. And these levies, currently, we are directing at the principal members. In other words, out of the total population covered of around 8.9 million, these are once-off deductions that are made only on the principal members that are around 4.1 million, all right? And the funding, yes, you may want to say that because they are paid by schemes to us, they are part of that contribution that members make. But when you compare that figure versus the annual contribution increase that members pay, it's less than 0.1%. And the reason is, in rand terms, what gets contributed to CMS as a levy per principal member currently
stands at R2.54. Whereas when you look at the annual contribution increases that were quoted of around CPI, you know, plus 4 or 5%, those are huge amounts of monies. But where the contribution increases end up here is that they end up with the administrators and the service providers. And that amount is far less than what we get. In fact, you know, it's a negligible amount. So in a sense, when we are talking to yourselves and asking for you to assist us in trying to get sufficient resources to be able to do our regulatory work, we are just saying, as an example, in 2019, because our funding is approved concurrently by National Ministry of Health and Treasury, we'd ask for an annual contribution increase of R3.43. And the agreement was, let's only give them R2.54. Our own view is, if you compare these amounts with what brokers are allowed to take from members' contributions, brokers are paid up to R100 per member. And it's arguable whether these brokers are adding value to members. For instance, if you had an active broker, they would advise you on your own option, honorable member, to say the option that you have chosen means you may run out of monies as early as end of June. But even myself, I'm a medical scheme member. I've never met or heard of from my own broker. And yet these are the people that are paid these monies, not on the basis of services that they've added, but it's a simple allocation to say Bonitas has got 100 members, there are 5 brokers, each member pays 100 rands and it goes to the broker, whether they do those services or not. And this is part of what we're trying to correct through legislation. I think honorable members would also have heard a cry that maybe these brokers are not even necessary. Powers need to be given to the members who must decide whether they want to use services of a broker or not. And at that point, then they can pay. But not just a blanket, blank check that's given to these brokers. Yeah, just on the suspensions. Chairperson, I hope I'm not going to open a can of worms. Because the last time that when we addressed yourselves, on the very same day we received an allegation of corruption at CMS. So I'm hoping that we're not going to get new ones. But what has happened, I think we addressed the portfolio committee on the 26th. Of August, and we got that first allegation, and then thereafter every week there was a set of allegations, and these allegations would confine themselves to either a pair of individuals or an individual in a unit at CMS, but largely they are making reference to, you know, unethical behavior, you know, corrupt relations with, you know, people in the industry. They are making reference to supply chain irregularities. They are making reference to lifestyles that are not matched by their earnings at the council. So in all of those instances, we've followed, you know, the procedures, and we've placed these officials on a precautionary suspension. We are starting now. We are at the tail end of the procurement, and we are working together with the SIU. And I think in the new week here, some of these investigations will start. But what is also happening is the SIU, I think, Chairperson, you'll recall, in our previous meeting we had said somewhere around March, April this year, we had suspended one official. And it turns out that when we referred those cases to the SIU, they also got a number of anonymous hot tips. So
some of these allegations, whilst they are new to the CMS, are not new to the SIU. So in a sense, we're working together and sharing this information so that we can expedite these investigations and take the appropriate action. Yeah, I think, Chairperson, let me give my colleagues to, maybe Cindy, you can start and talk to the 10.8 million deficit, the lease, and other finance related, and then we can give Michael, Mamsi, and then I also want Faresh and Gracie to talk to their relevant sections. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair and members. Coming back to the lease versus the building, National Treasury actually this year gave us guidelines on methodologies where cost savings can be incurred, and the lease versus purchasing was also one of their suggestions in their guidelines. But just going a bit back, in 2016, the Health Portfolio Committee of 2016 also raised this issue. And the Health Committee was also at similar time than now. And then we immediately went back to the offices and we started to investigate that option. And we actually contracted three independent evaluators to come and give us a market-related purchase price that we can start negotiating with the landlord. Those three values was then presented to the council, and the council gave us parameters to work between when we entering with the negotiations. At that stage, the landlords didn't entertain us our offer on the table, saying that the offer, we just ended up at a deadlock at that stage because the offers were totally different from the asking price and the price that we are willing to pay. So the gap was material. Between the offer of the office and then that of the landlord. But the issue didn't go away because even in our strategic operation sessions, we noted this as a strategic risk as our lease contract is ending now May 2023, which is in 4 years. So within 4 years, we must have a solution. So the offices then also then compiled this facilities committee. And this facilities committee is now looking into all the options, the costs, with contributing to all the different options, and that's a process that we are currently busy with. Then on the surplus funds, the 10.8 million deficit that we incurred, in September every year, you have to write to Treasury application. I actually have the application for that deficit here with me. You have to write to Treasury and apply whether you can retain those surplus funds. Naturally, Treasury then has the option to ask for that money to come back to the national fund, or if your application is successful, then you can retain your funds. But in the application, you have to note to Treasury what you're going to use this money for and how you're going to utilize it. So in the 2018-19 financial year, we mentioned to Treasury that we wanted to do the Fraud, Waste and Abuse Summit, which was a successful summit. It wasn't part of our original budget, so that summit then came from those surplus funds. The interns that was now mainly in the compliance unit, that wasn't also in the original budget, so that was also a strategic area that we motivate, that why we want to retain the surplus funds. Another strategic area that we highlighted to Treasury why we want to retain the funds was for the NHI related projects, strategic projects relating to NHI on consulting fees. So National Treasury then granted us to keep those surplus funds and utilize it on this project. Because it was not in the original budget, that those projects was not funded from that, and that's why the deficit then incurred. Yes, I think that's from the financial perspective. My input.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think, and also thank you for the opportunity to attend to some of the questions raised. Maybe let me start with the one around on benefits paid, because I think it's very important, because ultimately it's really about the contribution that you as a member pay. So if I was to explain it in simple terms, Chair, it would be to say that if I contribute 100 rands to a medical scheme in 2018, for instance, where did that money go? So that's what slide on benefits paid is talking about. But now if I was to break it down, what it says is that I paid 100 rands for my medical aid, 37 rands of that went to private to hospitals, right? And then 15 rands of the 100 rands that I paid to my medical aid went to pay medicines, you know, pharmacies, going to the hospital, I mean, going to a pharmacy to get pills or to buy medicine, I mean, to get medicines. And then the remainder, like, for instance, about 25 rands then, it went towards to, for a simple reason that when you're sick, for instance, you need to go, you have to have your blood test taken, for instance. So you'll need to go to a radiology, I mean, you'll need to go to a pathology, for instance, you know. So there'll be fees that will be attributed to those types of services. So in the main, you pay 100 rands to your medical aid, 37 rands of that goes to private hospitals, I mean hospitals in the main, and then 15 rands go to pay medicines, and then the other 25 rands go to paying specialists. For instance, the typical example is that you see here is that about 5 rands goes to paying your GP. So you get a minimal contribution that goes to a GP, which is really what you said. It should be a point of focus whereby a lot of funds should be attributed to primary healthcare, so that we ensure that we prevent a lot of these conditions, so that you don't end up ending in a hospital bed. So in simple terms, instead that a lot of the expenditure, Dr. Gwan also touched on it, a lot of the expenditure goes towards paying hospitals, which by design, in any case, are unregulated. Now, this is also linked to the second to the answer of the second question, where basically, Chair, you're asking about the benefits paid per event. Now, again, if I was to explain this in simple terms, that for the same type of service, for instance, I went to see a GP, depending where the GP is. A GP is in a hospital, whether it's, well, basically in this case, it would be a GP is residing in a private hospital. I'm paying almost 900 rand to that GP. For the same type of services, I'll be paying 300 rand if he was not in a hospital setting. So what basically this means is that there's a number of elements that contribute to this. It would be like there's an incentive to have a doctor sitting in a hospital setting because they drive incentive. There's also a section in our annual report that talks about the types of models used to pay for services. In the main, you find that you've got fee for service, which drives incentive. So what it says in simple terms is that it benefits me as a hospital to have a doctor sitting in my building, because a GP will see that patient. The likelihood is that the GP is going to recommend that person to sleep over in a hospital bed. Ultimately, the hospital benefits, you know. So there's a number of issues there. There might be an incentive that is also linked to it. But this is what we see from the data, is that for the same type of services, you pay more when you are in a hospital setting. That table also further explains the variance across various disciplines. For instance, you also see that in the mean, the one that is glaring for me will be for surgical specialists, for instance, you pay about 3,800 per event in a hospital setting. But if you're all outside hospital setting, you're paying about 1,100 and almost 1,200. So when you're in hospital setting, you're actually paying more for the same type of services. But obviously, the underlying factors to that are many. And then, but what we see is the correlation between the disciplines that sit in the hospitals and the volumes that, you know, that we pick up in those settings. So there might be an element of incentives. But again, Dr. Gabanis alluded to the fact around the fraud, waste and abuse, where the supply induced demand, just to make sure that somebody sits in the hospital bed because we want to generate more revenue for the hospital. So there's those elements that are attributed to some of these big differences between the same type of services, but you're actually paying out different amounts. And then the other one that I want to talk to, also Dr. Kwane touched on it, is the issue around co-payment. The question that was raised around why is the level of out-of-pocket payment more in open schemes compared to restricted schemes? So what happens is that the main answer to that question is the benefit design. The benefit design is more richer in the restricted schemes. That is the first answer. But the second answer to that question is that it is the range of benefits that you find in open schemes, because like I said, in the main, you find there's up to 23 benefit options in the open scheme. So it's pretty difficult for the members to compare. You might find that you're looking for a comprehensive plan, right? But within the open schemes sector, you've got about 5 comprehensive plans. How do you know which one is more relevant to you? As a result, you may choose the wrong one, only to realize that it doesn't meet all your health care needs, like Dr. Kabane said. So in the main, it might be the issue around benefit design, richness of benefit design in restricted schemes or employer-based schemes compared to open schemes. There's a number of interventions in play that could be put in play in this space. The first one is education. This is the role of a medical scheme to educate, communicate benefits to members so that at least you know what you are covered for, so that you don't get subjected to a co-payment along the way. That is the first one. The other opportunity here is the role of brokers. Dr. Gavan also mentioned to it, also touched on it, to say maybe there's an opportunity for brokers here to also play a critical role in terms of communicating to their members in terms of what they are covered for. And also when a member downstream encounters problems, then he's got somebody that he can talk to say, I'm experiencing these problems, how can I engage with the scheme better? But a lot of it is around the richness of benefits, number one. And then second, the complexity of the design itself. It looks like it's more complex in open schemes than in restricted schemes. So member education, product training, communication of what is covered is really key in this space to be able to address the issue. And it goes twofold. It's both by the medical scheme itself and also by the member to go through the brochure, understand what you're covered for, so that at least ultimately you're able to choose an appropriate plan.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity to respond. I think I will first the issue around the volume of complaints and whether it has to do with member awareness. I think the answer to that might be twofold, in a sense that members are becoming more aware of what their rights are, and of I think the availability of a third party arbitrator to adjudicate on their complaints. But in our engagements with regulated entities, especially medical schemes, we try and encourage the establishment of dispute resolution mechanisms within the schemes themselves to lessen the volumes on CMAs so that members can exhaust the internal remedies available to them. But what we find as well is that whenever you suggest that to members, to say that have you engaged your scheme, have you spoken to the medical scheme, the trust deficit that already exists, they no longer trust whatever comes from the medical scheme, so they are more willing to listen to somebody far removed from the medical scheme than the medical scheme itself. So but it's something that we encourage on a regular, that schemes must communicate the platforms that are available for members to raise these issues and attend to them, to sort of address those issues at that level and avoid the high volumes that CMS is seeing. But at the same time, because our mandate is to protect the interest of members, whenever we cannot turn them away and say that, you know, when a member needs treatment, urgent oncology treatment, you cannot say to that member, go back to the scheme and exhaust the mechanisms that are available to you. Because by the time they do that, their condition might have progressed quite severely. So that is to answer that part. The issue around the rulings and the high number of rulings that are issued in terms of open medical schemes in respect of or in favor of schemes, I think a large part of it has already been explained. Issues are along, you know, member understanding their benefits, the benefit design, and all of that. But what is also important is that CMS is a creature of statute. So CMS is restricted in the extent to which it can intervene to what the legislation provides for. So whatever rulings that we do, we make sure that we promote the provisions of the Medical Schemes Act and the registered rules of the scheme. Because once the rules of the medical scheme are registered, they are binding. And they are not only binding on members, but they are also binding on the scheme. And as we, so we cannot override the registered rules of the scheme. But there are interventions within CMS itself to make sure that when rules are being registered, those rules are fair to members. And I think there has been recent interventions, and I think the Parash maybe will address that, where a task team has been established within CMS, which involves various units. What we do is we then, on a regular basis, review the rules which have already been registered so that we can identify those that may have been registered but maybe are being interpreted in an unfair manner, or maybe that might lead to prejudice to members. So those are ongoing interventions that we sort of put into place to make sure that we still carry out our mandate of protecting the interests of members. And the other thing is, as Dr. Gaban has also alluded to, the issue of legislative shortcomings. You know, when you have a legislation that restricts you to what maybe, say for instance with PMBs, certain interventions are not covered, are not included there. So you cannot direct a medical scheme to fund that, whereas the legislation itself excludes it explicitly. So those are the other shortcomings that we have picked up. But as it has been indicated, there are measures to address those kind of issues. Then there was a question around benefits for members who are retiring. I'm not sure if maybe the I understand the questions, and I would seek for guidance if maybe I did not understand it correctly. But the essence of the matter is a member who continues to be on a medical scheme while having retired is entitled to the benefits that are covered on that particular benefit plan. So I think that another thing goes back to issue of benefit design. How is your benefit designed? Is it designed to cater for your specific health needs, or did you buy a benefit that maybe, you know, incurs more shortfalls than benefits for you? So again, it's a question of how then do we educate our members so that they know what is it that they are buying and to what extent are they covered before they can incur the shortfall. Regarding the backlog, the slide that demonstrated that it was for comparison purposes to indicate, to give context in terms of how we got to be where the backlog had incurred. And the nature of adjudication of complaints is that every complaint has a life of its own. And the turnaround times that we have is 120 working days. So with each passing day, it ages. And as it ages, it might fall outside of that time frame. So as we resolve the older complaints, some newer complaints might also fall into that. So it is always a constant juggle, if I can put it that way, that you have to make sure that the focus is not one-sided. So you focus on the backlog and on the new cases all at the same time. And obviously, Dr. Gaban has spoken to issues of capacity constraints within the unit, but those are the dynamics that we're dealing with. So with every complaint, or with every day that passes, a complaint will age. So it will keep falling. But we have substantially dealt with the bulk of the backlog through the same interventions as indicated, the intern paralegals that were afforded to us that allowed us to be able to at least have an even spread of the workload. I'm not sure if there's any that I have left out.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you, CEO. Dr. Lomo. My name is Grace Koza, the Head of Stakeholder Relations at CMS. Maybe let me start by acknowledging that I think the big part of why we exist is for the benefit of the ordinary members. And a big chunk of the work that we do is to educate them. The unfortunate part about it is that we have had serious challenges as an organization to reach out to the majority of the South African public that are members of the schemes. We are now working on creating platforms with the different regulated entities to ensure that the message is sent. But we do have an opportunity of directly communicating with the members. In the year that's under review, 2018-2019, we did participate on national platforms like the National Protection Consumer Protection Forum, which enabled us to literally reach out the more ordinary members than we could have done on our own. In the past, it was something that we embarked on, but we unfortunately realized that we're not reaching the members that we intended to. So we are partnering with other national departments. But it's also important, and I'm glad that MAMSI indicated the issue around our own regulatory mandate. There needs to be an awareness and synergy between the decisions that we make as a regulatory body and their impact on the ordinary citizens. So if we're looking at the approval of the benefits, we need to be able to communicate to the ordinary South Africans in the manner in which they will be easy for them to understand and absorb, but also just empower them. The reality is the majority of us, even those of us who are learned, who are members of these schemes, the way the rules and everything else is communicated could be a bit difficult and complex to consume and absorb. So we have tried, we've engaged for the first time the communicators and the marketers of most of these schemes to say, please, let's try to have a simplified language. What we've also done from our side, we've translated our communication material to 6 languages. We're hoping that going forward, we'll be able to articulate in all 11 languages. For the very first time also, we managed to reach out to all 9 provinces, as indicated, not only as CMS, but partnering with other national departments. So we did cover all 9 provinces. Thirdly, what we've also done is to make sure that we utilize local media channels in the provinces. So we're not big on national platforms, but we are big on provincial and local newspapers, radio stations, because we find that easier for our members to appreciate and understand, and the manner in which the message is communicated and packaged is more reinforcing of what we want to achieve to ensure that we reach them. But we do have another sector that we train, and that's your board of trustees, your principal officers, and the fund managers, and the brokers. It's important that all of those also are informed of our rules and regulation. What we've also done is for the first time, and I'm glad because it's aligned to what the HMI report has indicated, is that we've got 2 primary platforms where we enforce or we advance the training for board of trustees. So we've got the primary one. When a person is appointed to be a member of a scheme to be a trustee member, they come through CMS where they do the preliminary training on being a trustee. We've now partnered with GIPS to enhance that kind of level of training and elevate it. And in the second partnership that we have with GIPS, we really want to emphasize issues of ethical leadership, financial prudence, and other matters that we've talked about around fraud, waste, and abuse. It's important, parliamentarians, for us to do that, because even if you read the HMI report, what came out is the lack of accountability that BOT members do not hold the schemes. And it's important for us to empower them with the right information. Sometimes glaring and quite sad that ordinary members nominate ordinary members like themselves who have absolutely no clue of what is expected of them. Good, credible members in their communities, wonderful, good standing. But the technicalities of ensuring that these technical nuances that comes with running a medical scheme are appreciated and well understood becomes very difficult if they're not given that kind of empowering information and education. And that's why we split the education or the training, the basic one and then the advanced one. Secondly, as the CEO has indicated, the issue around brokers is still being debated, their relevance, but we are ensuring that we empower them. As we speak, we've just finished a 2-day training here in Cape Town. It is one discipline that needs proper and consistent engagement because it's critical for our people to really receive the services that that sector needs to give. And we believe strongly that while they exist, as per the legislature, our role is to ensure that they do the work that they're supposed to do. From the principal officers too, it is the issue around governance. We know we've talked a lot about their remuneration, which obviously becomes a big challenge if you're looking at their deliverables from a performance agreement point of view. So it's important for us to make sure that the incentives are not just commercial, but also appreciate the role that they have to play in empowering the ordinary members. Finally, our way forward, parliamentarians, there are two biggest objectives that we're looking at. One is to make sure that council approve our proposal to ensure that all medical schemes membership cards have a CMS call center. That will empower ordinary members to know that when they have difficulties, the reach to CMS is not through a certain process, it definitely is directly. Secondly, we also want to communicate a lot of the appeals board resolution, because a lot of our members, some of it could be repeat requests coming forward from ordinary members, when the fact that a certain resolution has been passed and it could empower ordinary members to understand how to mitigate some of the challenges they face in understanding their own medical schemes. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, I'm Paresh Prema. I'm the General Manager of Benefits Management at the CMS. I'll try to deal with the question around increases and a lot of issues around why contributions go up by the amount that they do every year. What are the drivers for that, those increases, and what the CMS is doing to try to reduce that. So the comment made by one of the members was, we see this 8 to 9% increase from medical schemes when CPI is around 4.3% currently. And it's concerning to us as well, because those outpace inflation, outpace salaries increases as well, and makes medical schemes unaffordable. But the balancing item for us is, because medical schemes are required to pay for claims for its members and they're not for profit, they need to make sure that whatever they collect in contributions is enough to pay for those claims. So the more they need to pay for claims, the higher the contribution increase needs to be, even though we still have out-of-pocket payments. So there is still that gap that still doesn't cover what members need in full. So most medical scheme increases are made up of two parts. One is the tariff, or the negotiated tariff that they have with the hospitals and the providers, and that's usually around CPI. And there's another element which we can't measure, and that's when benefits get abused or used more than they would normally be every year. And that's what leads to the increase in the claims that we see. One of the slides that was presented by Michael showed that every year claims increase by 8%. And if medical schemes don't collect 8% more, there'll be a gap between what it collects and what it pays out. And there needs to be a source for that money. Another reason why providers, or why we see an increase in the number of claims and the amount being claimed, is when we talk about our prescribed minimum benefits, our requirement in our Act says that it must be paid in full. So if a provider pays or charges more than they would normally charge for their service, the schemes are obliged to pay that in full. And there's an element where, as CMS, we can't control and reduce that amount. And that's part of where the supply-side regulator is suggested by the HMI to say, how do we regulate both sides? We have a scheme that is regulated very well by what they charge. They have to get approval from us before they charge that contribution. But the providers don't have to get any approval to charge what they feel is reasonable and fair. And I think there's an element which is outside of CMS's control, which we feel there's interventions like the HMI report and the NHI proposals would assist us in getting more traction on how we can control those costs. I think it's important that we understand that CMS is at all times helping to try to reduce the burden of that cost to its members, but it's also there to ensure that those claims are paid in full, because we want to reduce the number of complaints and we want to reduce the level of co-payments. I think just to add also on the benefits being running out, we have provided a brief description in the response that we sent through. But I think what the registrar also mentioned earlier about being informed as to what your benefits are when you purchase that option is very important. And we see that a lot of the times that it's being missed because members are not aware of what their actual health care needs are. And when it comes to the point of obtaining that care, it's run short. This may also suggest that the type of benefits and the number of options we have should actually be reduced, and we should try to find a way to provide a comprehensive package to everyone, not just based on your ability to pay, but also your need. And I think that all of these interventions, I think HMI and NHI both speaks to how do we achieve that. It's a way towards achieving that solution, and I don't think that I think CMS is very positive in the way in which we can try to get to that final endpoint. There was a comment around reserves and profits, and I think a comment made about administrators and buildings. Because medical schemes are not for profit, every rand spent or paid must go to healthcare and running of the scheme. We've seen in the one slide from Elizabeth that over 90 rands of your 100 rands go to pay for benefits. Under 10 rands goes to pay for, and that's what goes to pay for these buildings and all of these other parts that you see that you think are profit-making entities. We do have a challenge at CMS in that member education, not around only around benefits, but also the separation between the scheme and the administrator. Who actually pays for the benefits and the claims, and who actually does the admin for the scheme. We've also had that, and there were various initiatives put forward by the office to try to show the differences between who the scheme is and who the administrator is. And that's an ongoing process, and we feel we want to, providing, for example, a CMS number on the card would give members more clarity of who the regulator is and where we can get the information we need to deal with our claims and benefits. I think that's most of our challenges around contribution increases, and we want to try to help members be more informed in terms of what they get and what the increases are every year. I think we do also provide guidance it's in our annual report, to medical schemes around what those increases should be. We keep that so that they are informed when they go into those negotiations with those providers. It's also part of why the HMI's recommendation is that there's a pricing authority, because at the moment there isn't a negotiation allowed between schemes and providers. And if we can find a middle ground, we can cap those fees that I spoke about, where providers can charge what they feel they are worth and get paid for that, and actually what the actual cost of providing that service is to members. So all of these interventions, I'm hoping as CMS we can help to bring a more sustainable and more cost-effective medical schemes to members. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to address one question that I've overlooked here, and this is the contribution of the CMS to the NHI. I know we've covered it in the Q&A, but I think it's important that it should be noted that even under the current Act, that our mandate is to regulate these entities in a manner that is complementary to national health policy. So if national health policy is directing, everybody to move towards the NHI dispensation, it automatically places us in that space to make that contribution. So in a sense, if you look at the NHI white paper, it is very clear in terms of what must happen to this industry prior to the full implementation of the NHI. And some of the things that it is suggesting then, predate even the HMI report. Because part of what it was that white paper was saying is that there are too many benefit options. They need to be standardized. They need to be reduced to a minimum so that, any user or potential user can understand what they are buying into. So we're providing technical support. We are doing the technical work that will actually determine, out of these 200-plus options, you know, how many should there be? If we say we standardize maybe between 3 and 4, what entitlements would sit in each of those options? So that also begins to talk to that single standardized benefit option across schemes, which I said earlier on would be a predecessor, you know, to the NHI package. So that's work that we're doing at CMS here. The white paper also talked about consolidating small fragmented risk pools. It said schemes that have got less than 6,000 members, and I think PAMED is one of these, if I'm not mistaken, need to consolidate. And the principle sitting behind this here is that when you've got small pools, you know, and there's a risk profile of people that are aged and their disease profile is out of whack, the natural consequence of that is that higher contribution increase will be paid and you will run out of funds. So it's part of the game here. So NHI, basically, if you look at it, it says instead of having the 78 or 79 schemes, it says let's move towards one big risk pool. Because when you've got a big risk pool here, what happens is you get income and risk cross-subsidization, where the healthy cross-subsidize the sick, the old subsidized by the young, etc. And these are some of the principles that are embedded in the NHI universal healthcare dispensation. It also says government-funded schemes need to be consolidated as well, because they constitute a huge part of what is called the restricted scheme. And the main component there is coming from GEMS. So we're doing some work with government-funded schemes. We're establishing a forum. And we want to assist the minister by providing, you know, well-thought-out research and recommendations in terms of how these processes need to be carried. Because we see ourselves as the custodian of the Indus in the transition towards full implementation of the NHI. I'm sure NHI will never succeed if we allow the current dispensation to be chaotic, to remain uncompetitive, and for people to feel that it doesn't make sense to belong to schemes. Because when we all resign from schemes, we're going to overburden the public sector. So CMS is going to play that stabilizing role by making sure that as this reform unfolds, whatever negative impacts that are visited on the sector, we make sure that we mitigate against those risks. But one of the big things, that apart from the prescribed minimum benefits, is basically the anti-fraud, waste and abuse initiatives. I think about a week ago, the minister and the president were launching the health sector, you know, anti-corruption forum. CMS is part of that. And I think the underlying thinking there is that if there's corruption now, let's weed it out so that all these risks are not carried into the NHI dispensation. So you'll see all our actions are aimed at, you know, galvanizing the industry that we regulate to try and eliminate these things through, you know, putting clear rules in terms of who must do what and how people should conduct themselves. But finally, Chairperson, one of the key initiatives is establishing a central beneficiary register. The National Ministry and the Department, they have already started this National Health Patient Record System, where they've recorded, I think, in excess of 40-something million people in that. The missing part is how many people are accessing these services in the private sector. Who are they? You know, what schemes do they belong to? What options do they belong to? And how are they behaving in accessing the services that they are entitled to? So we're trying to create that register, that when you add it to that National Health Patient Record System, the minister can get a complete picture of all the population and be able to do proper planning in terms of looking at how the burden of disease is looking like in the entire country. So CMS is quite busy, Chairperson. apart from just regulating, and I know sometimes we're just seen as regulators, but a big part of what we do here is policy advice to the national ministry. Thanks.
If Dr. Mini has not given you a permanent job, then CMS will advise him to consider that. You seem to be permanent.
Check, just to add one part, the Minister of Health was at CMS to introduce Dr. Nicholas Crisp, and he asked us that in the process of setting up his office, that we assist, realizing that what we are doing at CMS is a microcosm of what to be on a bigger scale in NHR. And we said, where we can, when we have resources, we're going to assist him. And so that I just thought I'd add that. About permit, just to add about permit, since the CEO spoke about it, a few years ago when we were still at GEMS, there was a suggestion that permit should be sent to GEMS, and GEMS said never, we don't want them. So just for you to know that we are not in demand.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sukas, hold on to pack your bag as yet, because I need to give some announcements. No, thank you very much for what you have done. I would wish that you really assist us with your work going forward. It's not a fairy tale, it's a true story that in some parts of this country, a 14-year-old who reports to a doctor that I have a right iliac fossa pain, iliac fossa is down here, gets admitted into the ICU just for that and that alone. Because why? They fear there might be an appendix. Something that could be taken care of in any hospital and can take an emergency. And you know how we know that young person, 14-year-old, is texting a message to the relative sitting in the ICU that I'm sitting in the ICU because they think I've got an appendicitis. Now, you can't be so overpricing that at that level, because that hospital is short of patients to go to ICU. So we must put a patient who otherwise must be sitting far away, in not even in a high care surgical ward, somewhere far away there, looked after. If the pain starts, we take you to theatre and opener. It happens in this country. So if anybody says we must not regulate, really. So Department of Health officials, you are here. Next week after lunch, the Department of Health is coming here to present to us. We have heard a bit from the CMS, Council for Medical Schemes, that they are not able to comprehensively talk about about health marketing inquiry. But by the way, members, this document is available. Go read it yourself. I haven't read it myself. I just get snippets here and there. Read the document. It will assist you so that I haven't completed it. The 256 pages. I've read the executive summary. It's longer than... So when the minister comes to join us in the department next week, I see the Office of the DG is already also... There's no way you are going to escape not to share some light, even if it means you are giving us a story that says we have started consulting with the relevant institutions that are going to give responses, but we don't expect that you have all the responses on that, but it's not going to be possible for this committee not to hear a word from the department about that report. We just need to really prepare that you share with us in that scheme. So firstly, honorable members, you also must remain because the announcements will touch you. You were expected to come here and present to us at 4. Obviously, if you started at 4 and we are finishing at this time now, you must be credited for doing so well. This office provided dinner for all of us. And dinner will be served as soon as we finish here now. We will walk to... Honorable Chirwa knows best where we are going. It's on the ground floor of Mark's building. If you get lost, you follow Honorable Chirwa at the ground floor of Mark's building where we are all going to be served dinner there. Please go past there, even if you take two or three bites. Otherwise, she's going to report a fruitless and wasteful expenditure because we have already provided for you. Honorable members, we meet again at on Tuesday, the 15th at 9:30. We're meeting here at 9:30. Read and prepare NHLS